This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacia, wishing you a happy new year. We are ringing in 2019 and yet taking a look back at the year that was on the State of Things. Amanda Magnus is one of two new producers on the show, came on board in January after she moved to North Carolina from Wisconsin. Some of her favorite conversations from last year included a couple of our recurring segments on the show, like the Monday Meet and Movies on the Radio. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what you were doing before you got here.
So I worked on a talk show that was news and arts and culture, but it felt like my job was really dominated by the news. And so when I saw this opening, I was really excited by an opportunity to do more arts and culture segments. So that was really what drew me down here. Also, I came down and it was beautiful when it was freezing in Wisconsin. And then I met all the wonderful staff and just fell in love with the place.
Well, one of the segments you want to talk about and that you helped learn a bit, helped you learn a bit about North Carolina was to focus on the Eastern Band of the Cherokee. Tell us more.
So WUNC's education policy reporter Liz Schlemmer went out to Western North Carolina and met two Cherokee language teachers there and talked to them about the massive effort that's underway there to save the language. So there was two brothers, Jake Lai and Micah Swimmer, and there are only 226 remaining Cherokee speakers, and most of them are over the age of 50. So it's really important for these people to save their language.
Well, let's listen to a clip from a conversation that starts with Cherokee language students practicing their speaking skills.
She just that good at good history.
A good
idea.
A good idea.
Yeah, there's a bit of elementary school classroom in the Cherokee Language Immersion School, and I'm talking to Liz Schlemmer, WNC Education Policy Reporter. What's going on there?
So this is from the new Kadua Academy Immersion School, and that was a little girl in the third or fourth grade who was introducing herself, and then her teacher was responding. And one of the issues here at this immersion school, they were telling me, is that it's harder to get truly fluent speakers to teach all of these classes. Obviously, they're highly conversational, but that teacher there is not an enrolled member of the tribe. She is from a different part of North Carolina and took some classes in college. So trying to create that fully immersive environment is just a struggle these days.
Tell us more about some of the other barriers, because if it's like other cultures who have not come to the United States, but find themselves now in this dominant culture where English is now the dominant language, oftentimes there is, young people are discouraged, or at least in certain generations. Was that any part of the Cherokee experience?
Yeah, that is something that I heard from Jake Lai Swimmer, that one of his former teachers said that when she was a little girl and she was in public school, she spoke Cherokee at home and she didn't speak English very well. And she would take tests in English and get zeros in them, and she didn't understand what the zero was, and she would make little faces in it. She thought it was a face that she could put a smiley face in. There was that whole era of assimilation. But also, if you imagine trying to speak a language where there are only 226 speakers, this isn't something where you can go take a class at a community college or do Duolingo or Rosetta Stone. The materials just aren't there, and they have to create all of their own material. So as I was walking around this immersion school, you would see games and flashcards and posters on the wall that were all handmade or homemade or made within the tribe.
And as you say, all the more difficult, because this is not exactly a vocabulary-driven language. It's all about nuance and ways in which words reconfigure to create new meaning.
Yeah, I was told that there are Cherokee language dictionaries, but it's difficult because the word's not going to work the same every time. So one teacher created his own. He had this little booklet that he carried around everywhere where he'd written all of his own notes.
Jake Alai and Micah obviously think this is important as part of the larger question of cultural preservation. How important is it to the 16,000 or so enrolled members? Is this an important issue for the Eastern Band?
Well, it's important enough that the tribe supports that immersion school. They support a number of initiatives. But I still also heard from Jake Alai some frustration about how much they're up against and how hard everyone would have to work to move this forward. You can see in his own journey, he started hearing Cherokee from his grandmother when he was a child, and then he took it upon himself. He took Cherokee language in high school, he took it in college, and he started learning word by word and creating that that booklet of his. But that's been a decades-long journey, and he's a teacher, and he's still not fluent. So if you can imagine that what he's asking is that other people would need to take it on to that extent. You know, it takes years to learn a language, and he even said that he feels like some days there's so much more that he could do to learn and to pass it on to his own daughters.
Well, and you talked about just a second ago the fact that he heard it from his grandmother. If you're not hearing it at home, then again, the importance to you of this language and why you would even want to take the time to learn it, it might be a more difficult sell.
Yeah, he talked about how he would try to teach some of these words to his daughters, and that they must have thought, oh, my dad's crazy, he's rambling in some other language, this is nonsense. But now his oldest daughter is in kindergarten and has him as a teacher, and said, she's starting to really capture it and pick it up and have conversations with him.
Well, and he had a great story that he told you about just that.
And so when I'm telling my kids stuff like, we hug up, can I, we hug up, get in the car. Yesterday, my little girl in the grocery store over there, and I was telling him, can I, nula, hurry, quickly, can I, come here. And my little girl saying, can I, to her little sister. So that little bit made my day.
That was Jake Eli Swimmer, a Cherokee language teacher, from a conversation with a WUNC reporter, Liz Schlemmer. And I'm talking with State of Things producer Amanda Magnus about some of her favorite segments from last year. What did you like about that one?
What I really liked about that one is that Liz wove in this personal story from these two brothers and their experience of the Cherokee language with this larger effort to save the language, and really took it to a personal place. I also thought she did a great job reporting the piece and spending significant time in developing relationships with these two people, and it really touched me.
Yeah, really good reporting and good stuff to have on our show. Another segment that taught you about North Carolina was about snakes. What excited you about it? Because you don't like snakes that much, right?
Now I like snakes. I've never lived in a place with venomous snakes before in my life. And so I love being outside. Exactly. We have 6 venomous species here in North Carolina. And I saw one when I was out running, and it really scared me. And so I thought, okay, I really need to learn about this. I need to be educated so that I can protect myself. And I pitched this segment when Anita Rao was guest hosting, and she was totally on board and let me have a lot of fun with it.
All right, let's listen to a clip with our interview with herpetologist Jeff Bean.
So I want you to take me inside the mind of a snake for a second. And so I sort of, if me and a snake are together in my yard, I see them, I know how I'm going to react. What is going on in their head? What does a snake do when it senses that another being, potentially a human, is nearby?
It depends on the species of snake, and it depends on what that being does. If that being leaves it alone, it usually does nothing. If it happens to be asleep, it might not even know you're there. Usually, most snakes, if you encounter them and they're coiled up somewhere where they want to be, they'll remain completely still and hope that you don't see them or bother them, if they even know you're there at all. If you do disturb them, the first thing they'll probably do is try to get away. If they don't have an outlet to get away, or you get right up in their face or try to pick them up and step on them, they might bite to defend themselves, depending on the species and the individual. Some snakes don't bite no matter what you do to them. And some individuals within a species have more of a tendency to bite than others. Just like people, they'll have a shorter fuse than others.
So it may be that we perceive snakes as aggressive, but actually they are just defending themselves.
Right. There's no such thing as an aggressive snake. The only aggressive animal I've ever encountered are humans. Anything that's called aggressive, it's almost always defending itself. It's defending itself, its family, its territory. If animals were aggressive, we'd be attacked by them as soon as we walked outside our house constantly. I guess you could say a predator might be aggressive. A shark that's trying to eat you, it's aggressively feeding on you. But a snake is not going to attack you to feed on you. It's going to bite you to defend itself. It's acting defensively, not aggressively.
And so you say it's important for us to understand that the snakes that may be living in our yard, for example, have probably been there for a long time. And there's an important reason why we should let them continue to live there. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, most people, if they see a snake in their yard, if they're afraid of snakes, they're going to freak out and wonder how it got there. But chances are it's been there its entire life, maybe in their neighborhood, and they've just never seen it before. Go back inside and watch TV for an hour or so, and you probably never see it again.
Why shouldn't we move them?
Well, because they're part of the world, they have home ranges, and most snakes know exactly where they are. If you move them, they're going to be lost. Just like if you moved you or me out to California or somewhere, the first thing we do is try to get back home, and snakes are going to try to do that too. They're going to try to get back to something that's familiar. Most animals have territories that they're familiar with. If you feel like you have to move a snake, usually a short distance translocation, something less than 200 meters is probably what's recommended, so that it's away from your front doorstep, but it still knows where it is.
So you're not disorienting it too much.
Right.
That was our guest host, Anita Rao, speaking with herpetologist Jeff Bean on our show this summer. My guest is State of Things producer Amanda Magnus, sharing some of her favorite segments from 2018. So what stood out for you?
So first of all, the online article, I titled it, Why You Should Let a Copperhead Live in Your Yard, Debunking Snake Myths, and it blew up online. So many people saw it. I think it was the provocative title, but it really kind of drew a lot of attention to this segment. The other thing that I really liked is Jeff compared snakes with people and really helped you empathize with snakes, which sounds kind of silly, but actually made me feel a lot more connected to them and less afraid.
Do you feel better about snakes now in North
Carolina? I definitely do, and I feel confident walking outside and hiking and running and just knowing that if I see a snake, I'm just going to leave it alone, and it will leave me alone.
Amanda Magnus, producer on The State of Things, learning as she goes. Just ahead, we'll hear more about some of her favorite segments from the past year on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, wishing you a happy new year. And we continue our series of conversations with State of Things staff about their favorite segments from 2018. I'm talking with Amanda Magnus right now, who's sharing some of her picks from her very first year on the show. Your next few clips are from Monday Meets that you produced this year. Now, this is kind of an interesting thing. Public radio producers don't get to do this much because we're warned that you cannot spend 1 hour with one person. I've seen the data that prove it doesn't work, except for our audience numbers that show quite the opposite. But what was it about this? And what do you like about this kind of producing?
Well, for the Monday meet, we do two separate 1 hour long pre-interviews. And so it's intimidating to produce, basically, because it's a lot of time with one person. But that's why I like it, because you really get to kind of develop a relationship and really dig into this person's story. And you get to ask questions, really probing personal questions of people that are not socially acceptable, but are totally fine when it's, oh, I'm producing this hour-long show about your life. Can I please ask you?
And man, I like snakes. So, you know, I'm exactly. Kind of an oddball. Anyway, tell us about this first clip with an interview with Duke psychologist Sarah Gaither.
So Sarah Gaither is a biracial woman. Her mom is white. Her dad is black. And she grew up her whole life with people questioning her identity, especially when she was out with her dad. She really presents as white, not biracial. And so she's been kind of grappling with this for her whole life. And so she dedicated her life to researching biracial individuals. And so right now she's the principal investigator of Duke's Identity and Diversity Lab.
All right, let's listen to a clip of a Monday meet with Sarah Gaither. Here she's talking about why she carries a photo of her family in her wallet at all times.
So ever since I applied to undergraduate, actually, I showed up for a Black scholarship interview, not at UC Berkeley, but at another school I will not name, that when I showed up for my Black student interview, they simply told me, oh, the Hispanic interviews are in the other building. And I had no way to prove to this person at that point in time that I really was biologically Black. I had a Black father. And so I've found it easier for my existence to carry around a photo every single day of my life since then.
How often do you find yourself using it?
Pretty often, actually. It's kind of sometimes more of like a party game, though, to be honest, where someone will bring me somewhere and they'll be like, oh, guess what race she is? And you sort of become this trick, right, where I confuse everyone because I physically don't look like what people would expect a biracial Black-white person to look like.
And then you get into the most difficult question of all, which is that in a country like ours, where racism plays such an important part in politics and the political and social order, it is a scourge. So concentrating on race becomes the problem. And yet without a strong sense of your own racial identity, particularly as a minority, you can be lost. You have to have some sense of who you are, particularly when you're defined by others. How do you see all of us navigating, and where does the multiracial demographic fit into this kind of a question?
Yeah, so I think we all have, no matter what race we are, we all have this tendency to want to belong to a group. We all have this innate desire to belong to something that's bigger than just ourselves, right? And I think that's one thing that we know the mixed race population struggles with a lot is that belonging issue. They're never white enough, black enough, Asian enough, Latino enough, whatever the case may be. And so it's that struggle of finding that sense of self, that sense of place. For me, it's as a researcher, it's interesting in that it wasn't until the year 2000 that the census even allowed mixed race people to mark more than one box. And that's relatively recent history for our demographics and how it is we count this group. So I think we're behind the times in a lot of our sectors, whether it's government, healthcare, education, and then our own research, which is the void I'm trying to fill right now.
Well, part of that, too, is because in some situations there are benefits that accrue, there are changes in services available and all of that. So picking one for some people becomes very important, whether it's ultimately important or even to them or not, right?
Right. And as a biracial person, if you're forced to pick one, that's kind of asking you to also deny the other, yeah. Right? So it's sort of this game of, well, if you only give me one choice, should I play the race card game or should I not if you are part white and part minority? Or if you're dual minority, is one of your minority identities going to be more beneficial to you in a given situation or context? And we're doing some new research right now to show the strategic racial passing actually is viewed pretty negatively by most people in society, almost like we're being dishonest, even if on a form we don't have a choice to mark that we're more than one thing. So I think it's this new question we're all going to be struggling with as a society as this group continues to grow.
You've also done other research on what it's like to identify black or white, and you've done that by sort of asking people to write about one parent or another and then have communication with a member of one race or another. Tell us about that.
I try to focus on some of the positive aspects of biracial identity, too. And so what a lot of our work is trying to argue is that if you are biracial or have these multiple identities, this actually leads to what we call identity flexibility, or you're able to cross diverse spaces more easily compared to people from monoracial backgrounds. So we get a biracial black white person to think either about their white identity or their black identity and have them talk to either a same race white partner or same race black partner. And you find that that simple mindset causes those interactions to go much better. But getting someone to think about their white identity and talk to a black partner, you see more typical cross-race negative interaction outcomes. So it really highlights this malleability of biracial individuals and the fact that they might have an extra tool to help navigate different types of spaces.
But also the importance to us all, whether for good and ill, of creating an identity. Have we given any thought to how this whole mechanism works, this socialization that allows us, in fact requires us, to identify so strongly with a group? You know, and in some cases leads to the amount of hate and fear that we're seeing, a loathing of the other group because you've identified so strongly with yours. It seems fairly destructive behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I think social psychology was founded on this idea of in-groups and out-groups, right? So the original social psychologist was trying to understand how the Holocaust even occurred. Well, how could people hate someone of a certain racial or ethnic group so much without even knowing them, right? So we have this innate tendency to want to protect our groups. And so I think for biracial people, that's where this confusion kind of comes around. Which group would you want to protect more than others? Are there certain contexts that makes one identity more salient than the others or more important than the other? That's why I think they're a great test for this question of what if we do have multiple groups, which I always argue in my work we all do.
That's a clip from my interview with Duke psychologist Sarah Gaither. I'm talking with State of Things producer Amanda Magnus about some of her favorite segments from 2018. So you do the pre-interview and you're talking with her for 2 hours. You're getting all this information. Then you hear the show, which is a compressed version of this. So what stood out for you in the conversation that finally aired?
Sarah was a really great person for me to have as my first meet because there's such a strong tie between her personal stories and the work that she does, and both are really, really interesting. And so I love the interplay between those personal stories and also some of the really interesting cutting-edge research that she's doing. Both of those really appealed to me and I think packaged together made a really great meet.
Well, the second clip is from an interview with Jason Brown, an NFL football player turned farmer. Tell us more.
So Jason Brown was in the NFL for 7 seasons. He played for the Baltimore Ravens and the St. Louis Rams. And then he surprised everyone and came back to North Carolina to run a farm.
Let's listen to Jason Brown talking about his older brother, Lunsford, and when he graduated from basic training.
It was September of 9th of 2001, okay? And everyone knows what happened 2 days later. We went from a country of peace to a country of war really fast. And so over the next 2 years, he was stationed in Germany for a year and a half before he was called into service in Afghanistan and then Iraq. And meanwhile, Yes, little brother, you know, still being selfish, you know, full of ego, pride, making a name for myself at Carolina. And, you know, out of sight, out of mind, I had kind of grown disconnected from older brother. And a couple of years had passed. This was early in my junior year at Carolina. We had just finished up with training camp with a scrimmage, and coach was going to allow us to go out and eat dinner with our parents. And so I'm sitting behind my mother on the passenger side of the car, and I was going to take this opportunity to vent with my mother with everything that's wrong with my life at the time, right? And if there's any shoulder you can get and cry on, it's going to be mama's shoulder. And so I'm like, Mom, look, we had a bad season last year. And you know what? The writing's on the wall. It's going to be a bad season this year as well, because all the guys are selfish. They're only thinking about themselves. And yeah, kind of ironic, right? You know, me pointing the finger still at other people. And this goes on for about 10 minutes. And my mother doesn't say a word. And I'm thinking she's up there, like, she's asleep. I'm like, Mama, like, what are you going to say? Because usually she's like, oh, baby, you know, everything is going to be all right. You know, you just do your best. You just keep working hard and everything's going to be okay. She didn't say that. All of a sudden, she lashed out at me. And she said, you need to shut up. You need to shut up. And I didn't see this coming. She said, nothing of what you're going through in your life right now can compare to what your older brother is going through, fighting and serving our country in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's all she said. But literally, if there was any hot air that I had in my balloon, it deflated, mm-hmm. like real quick, like, like it all deflated. And here's what it did. It exposed me for who I was and what I was. Like, you daggone right. I should have eaten that big piece of humble pie a long time ago.
Add to that the fact that your brother, who you felt so close to and who had been an important part of your story all the way through,
yes.
was killed in Iraq. What impact did that have on you? Where were you in your career when you heard that, and what effect did that have on you?
Yeah, so that was literally less than a month after my mother gave me that tongue lashing, where my parents, they received the dreadful knock at the door. That they were suited and booted to inform them that Lunsford was, he was just slain in service. And that rocked my world. I fell and I hit rock bottom, all right? Because I didn't know if I wanted to continue playing football anymore.
How many years had you been playing by then?
That was my third year at Carolina. Okay. I didn't know if I wanted to continue going to school anymore. Yeah. Because my reality is saying, what is real and what isn't? I mean, if you can't hold on to and keep those loved ones that you hold so dear, it's like what am I working for then?
You did continue, though. Forgive me for interrupting, because
yeah.
you did continue, and I wonder what caused you to make that choice to continue playing football and then go on to the NFL.
So it's a harsh fact of life that we're all going to lose loved ones, and the longer we live, we're going to lose even more loved ones. And so the thing is, I said, you know, I cannot sit here and continue to wallow in my pity and self-doubt. What can I do to move forward to honor Lunsford's legacy, you know, to honor his memory? And I said, you know what? I've got to be the best person that I can be. I've got to be the best husband I can be. I've got to be the best football player that I can be. And here's what gave me the constant reminder is that, you know, so Lunsford, he was slain by a mortar attack. It's a mortar explosion. And a piece of shrapnel pierced through his dog tag exactly where his heart was. And Lunsford's wife gave me that torn dog tag, all right, that was pierced all the way through it. And here's what I did. I wore Lunsford's dog tag, pointy edge turned in right over my heart, so that after I put on my tight shoulder pads and after I put on my tight jersey, I could feel it literally piercing a hole right there in my chest. And nobody knew that it was there except for me. And I went out to every practice and to every game with that thorn in my side, literally as a constant reminder to never make excuses, to never quit, to never give up. And so that's what propelled me to, you know, to give that extra push every step of the way.
That's an interview with professional football player turned farmer Jason Brown. I'm talking with Amanda Magnus, one of the producers on The State of Thing, who is sharing her favorites from 2018. I love doing that one. I love doing them all, but this one was so striking to me for some of the contrast. But what did you like about it?
He had so many good stories, and he was such a good storyteller. And I felt like all of his stories really built on each other, and there was a strong thread throughout his whole life, I felt like. And it also took me months to get Jason on the air. He's super busy running a farm, and so it was a lot of back and forth, and it was a lot of talking to him at like 8 o'clock at night when he was done with the farm work, and just having these really deep conversations with him about his life. And he's the kind of person where you ask him one question, and he's just off.
Third meet we're going to listen to today is with Marwan Irani. Tell us more about him.
So he's the co-founder and executive chef of Chai Pani Restaurant Group. They have restaurants in Asheville and outside the Atlanta area. His background is really interesting. He has no formal culinary training, but he is a celebrated chef, and he's led a really interesting life, and he was just a really fun person to talk to.
Well, let's listen to some of the conversation with Marwan Irani. Here he's talking about his idea of service.
In one of our kitchens in Chai Pani Decatur, painted above the wall in the kitchen, it says mastery and servitude. The idea being that if you want to be really, really good at what you do and really be successful, the only way to do that is this idea of servitude. And it comes again from India and my spiritual upbringing and background, and this idea that you start with giving back and you build a business around that. And when I opened the restaurant, my idea of taking care of people was my family, my wife and my kid, and that's why I did this. But the minute the first employee walked in through that door, I knew that that it was no longer about taking care of just my family. Now, as much of a responsibility as one feels towards a wife and a child, that same responsibility was now transferred to that first employee and the second and now the 200th, and every customer that walked in through the door, the mailman, the parking meter guy, they're all my community. And if I'm going to open my doors for business, my wife and I are in service of this community. That's what we're there for.
Today you own 4 restaurants, 1 bar and lounge that serves food, and you also created something called Brown in the South Supper Series. Talk about the Brown in the South Supper Series.
Well, this whole time, I mean, my sense of identity is still this kid from India that grew up with this Western sensibility, that lived all these years in the Bay Area and now lives in the South. I never thought of myself as a Southerner. And I was having a conversation with another Indian chef, Vish Bhatt in Oxford, Mississippi, who's got a fantastic restaurant there too called Snack Bar. And we started talking about identity because he grew up mostly in the South. And we're talking about how it feels. And he said, no, I feel like a Southerner first and then an Indian second. And that really struck me. Like, yeah, I've been living here now for, you know, since 2005. At what point do I stop saying I'm an Indian that happens to live in the South and start saying I'm a Southerner that happens to be of Indian origin? And the more I looked around, the more I realized that people don't do that as often as they should, because the South has such a strong identity that goes back so far with such a long history, that when you think of the South, you have the sense of, well, this is what the South looks like. And yet, here's all of us that have been living here for as long, you know, my daughter grew up here. We're not claiming it. So him and I started this idea of having a supper series, because of course as cooks and restaurateurs, you know, our conversations have to have food, and that's where we sit down and talk around that dining table, and that's how we engage with our community and anybody we want to talk to. That's the only way we know how. And we reached out to other people that looked like us, that was brown in the South, that were not either Latino or Puerto Rican or you know, from Mexico or from anywhere in the world, that didn't look Southern but were Southern, and said, let's start actively standing up and being counted as Southerners that happen to come from all over the world, but let's change what people think of when they see the South. And that's how the series started. It got this, picked up this sort of traction of its own, and it's, I feel, is an important conversation that's happening around our dining table, and we're trying to invite other people to it.
What's happened as a result? What kind of conversations and sort of transformation, if any, do you see?
Well, I mean, more and more people sort of, you know, at least in the culinary field, sort of raising their hands and said, yes, I'm a Southerner first too. Yes, I may be from Sri Lanka, I may be from Brazil, I may be from, you know, anywhere in the world, I may be from Africa, from Europe, but I'm a Southerner too. I live here, I'm going to claim it. And a number of chefs, 5 of us now, you know, have cooked a couple of suppers where we keep inviting other chefs to join the conversation. So little chapters are starting to evolve. You know, there's going to be a brand in the South. I don't know what we'll call it, on the West Coast, and then one up North. And then last month, or well, in September, Time Magazine did a issue they called it the Southern Issue, and Stacey Abrams was featured on the cover. And there was an article in there about, you know, 30 people that are changing the South. And I got included in that list primarily because of our work through Brown in the South.
Asheville-based chef and restaurateur Marwan Irani, and I am talking with State of Things producer Amanda Magnus about some of her favorite segments from 2018. That was challenging because he was in Asheville. And generally speaking, when we're going to spend an hour with somebody, that show's really got to carry every minute. We want them in the studio so I can make eye contact and they're in touch with me. But we knew, and after talking with you about your pre-interviews, this guy is such a great storyteller. We're going to have no trouble, even if I can't make eye contact. What'd you like about this?
So I think what really drew me to Marwan is the fact that he's followed his passion for his entire life. And he followed his passion when he left business school before getting his degree. And he's followed his passion of food and has turned into this really successful career for him. And he's been doing some really interesting work. We heard some of that in that clip in particular, not only in transforming the service industry, but also in changing the way that people think about the South.
We will find out more about what Amanda Magnus thinks about the state of things and the programs that she helps us produce when our program continues after this. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, looking back at the year that was with State of Things producer Amanda Magnus, sharing some of her favorite segments from 2018. And the next clip you've chosen is from one of our regular segments, Movies on the Radio. Talk about what goes on behind the scenes for that one.
So once a month, we and movie experts Marsha Gordon and Laura Boys pick a theme, and then for the whole month, the producers are tasked with finding listeners to call us and record their pick for that theme. And so the producer is scheduling calls with listeners, talks to all the listeners, and records them. It's a really good way for us to interact with the listeners. And then after we have all those clips recorded, you, Frank, go in and do your editing magic and add really cool sound from the film. So we have this great finished clip that we play during the conversation to kind of spark discussion between you and Marsha and Laura.
I have to say, not only is it a great segment, and am I happy to do it because Marsha and Laura are such geniuses, and it's a fun and smart segment as far as I'm concerned, but it lets us play radio, which on a talk show you don't always get to do. So actually cutting the tape and working with the listener clips and the movie clips, that's the fun of radio, and I'm sure happy to have that once a month. In October, you were assigned Movies on the Radio with the topic comic campy horror movies. Was that fun?
It was so fun. So we had actually picked a completely different topic. And then we were looking at the calendar, and the date that really lined up for everyone was October 31st. And so we decided, well, we kind of have to do something. It's Halloween. And so I was secretly in my heart advocating for something related to horror movies because I love horror movies. And I really felt like I hit the jackpot when we decided on comic and campy.
Let's listen to some of our Movies on the Radio discussion campy horror films featuring Laura Boys and Marsha Gordon.
What I like about these films and about this topic is that obviously the point of a horror film is to scare you, right? It is a visceral reaction. People want to close their eyes. People want to scream, whatever your reaction is to, or not see them at all because they're too scary if you're Laura. And then, of course, a comedy, the whole point is to make us laugh. And so that combination of anxiety and release is actually really wonderful because a lot of these films I had not seen before, and I watched a bunch of them in preparation for the show, and I had such a good time. And sometimes you're laughing at them, and sometimes you're laughing with them. Sometimes the gore is preposterous. Sometimes it's pretty gruesome, and so you really do have an earnest combination of that kind of body anxiety that is then released by laughter.
Laura, could you even watch?
I watched the trailers. These things, horror movies always reflect their times. They talk about the anxieties that we have in our culture. And most of the films we're talking about today are from the Reagan era. There are a lot of high-waisted acid-wash jeans on screen. And we know we're going through a renaissance of horror movies right now.
And a renaissance of 80s and 90s culture and fashion.
It's 80s are the new 60s.
80s are the new 60s. And I have to say, you know, it reflects our terror and desperation over the current state of the world.
And the kind of, but also that a lot of satire, too. The fact that the lack of earnestness, right? So that was certainly part of the 80s as well. Irony, I think, is kind of part of it.
I don't know. There's such a thin line between trying to make a bad movie and actually making a bad movie, or, you know, trying to make a good movie and have it not turn out right.
I think we have both on the list today.
Yeah. Let's get started.
Hi, my name is Bucky Grimm from the burgeoning metropolis of Mount Airy, Maryland, and the film I've chosen is the 1982 film Creepshow. It's funny now, but it's the film I took my future wife to on our first date, lying to her and telling her it was a musical. It's a film split into five little segments, connected by a bit of a beginning, and it's kind of a homage to the early horror comics in the 50s.
You'll scream at ghastly ghouls, cringe at weird kids, and shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
This is going to be extremely painful, Mr. Verrill.
It's a campy, humorous, sometimes scary trip. There's a segment called They're Creeping Up on You with E.G. Marshall playing a germaphobe. And that one stuck with me for a long time. He gets his comeuppance at his biggest nemesis, which are cockroaches, invade his apartment.
What's the matter, Mr. Pratt? Bugs got your tongue?
And you see at the ending that his corpse gets totally eaten away by, and the cockroaches kind of descend upon him. By the way, my wife will never let me choose another film.
Bucky Wise Grimm, Creepshow, 1982.
Bucky, well, you got to talk her into it because this is such a fun. First off, I remember so vividly the poster design for this film. I don't know if you all remember this, but it's this great font on a poster. I mean, this must have really resonated in my imagination. I'm sure I did not see it when it first came out, but probably a few years after. But this is a killer combination of Stephen King and George Romero, who directed, of course, Night of the Living Dead. And it is, I mean, it has a funny attitude about it, even if it's supposed to be a little creepy. And one of the taglines is the most fun you'll ever have being scared. So it knows, right, it's knowing right about its kind of deployment of these two things.
Well, that anthology structure dates back a really long way. I mean, Charles Dickens and Edgar Allan Poe used anthologies to tell their stories. A lot of 19th century writers of the supernatural. So that's something that came into film and then into TV with things like The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits.
And the frame for this film is also pretty interesting, and it recurs in some ways throughout some of the films we're talking about today, because it's a young boy who's into these horror stories, and his father's super disapproving and a total jerk, and, you know, the son wishes
him ill.
Oh, a
little autobiography, do you think, there?
could be. But anyhow, so that's a playful part of it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about the anthologies is it allows you to surgically target those the creepiest things and the most scary things. So there's the bug fear and the fear of, you know,
right.
And then you can put them all into one film. Let's move on.
My name is Robin Vushnik, and I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. The movie I chose is Return of the Living Dead, written and directed by Dan Urbanek. I actually saw this movie for the first time on cable Halloween night, 1986. I stayed up late after the parents went to bed, and I was only about 8 years old at the time, so it definitely made an impression on me. It's funny, it's over the top, and it has some absolutely terrifying zombies in it.
Who's there?
The zombies in this movie are indestructible and also crafty. Like, they figure out how to use the first responder, which is basically a food delivery service.
Hold it right there! Brains are all blanking, brains out! Send me the
cops. So it's pretty much like Order Up for Zombies. Yeah, it's a fantastic movie and one that still holds up today. Lots of comedy and pretty great effects for the time.
The time was 1985.
Man, this is truly a perfect horror comedy film. It has everything. It is funny. It is creepy. It is fast-paced. It's like boom, 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 boom. I mean, some of the lines and some of the scenarios, at one point they strap down this like half woman and they're interrogating her about like, well, why do you want to eat brains? And she's like, well, it kind of hurts being dead and it makes you feel better, you know? And so it's just, it's a knowing film. Mm-hmm. So it's not a film that you laugh at. And that, I think, makes it all the more fun.
That was some of our conversation with film experts Marcia Gordon and Laura Boys about campy, funny horror films. State of Things producer Amanda Magnus chose it as one of her top segments of the year. She's sharing those favorites now. So tell us more about that and sort of what you like. Because it's interesting. You've got these, you're talking to all these listeners, and then you don't really know how the show is going to come together. I mean, that's a case where that day's show can be really a surprise in some ways.
Exactly. And that topic in particular, I felt like we just elicited some really interesting personal stories from the listeners. And not every topic does. And so it's really fun. And it's hard to predict what topic is going to hit that. And it's also hard to predict what Marcia and Laura, especially Laura, does not like scary movies. So that one really could have gone either way, but I feel like we're really lucky that it went as well as it did.
This last clip you chose centers on a documentary film called The Jazz Ambassadors. Remind us about this one.
So this was a documentary that was screaming at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, and it focused on this program by the U.S. government that sent jazz musicians around the world during the Cold War to kind of be representatives of the United States and the American way of life. But some of these musicians were African-American, and this was a really interesting time in our history where African-American people didn't have a lot of rights. And so there was this tension between we're living in this society where we're, you know, constantly being bullied or denigrated, and then we're being sent out as representatives of this nation. And so that tension was really interesting, and I had no idea about this history.
Well, let's take a listen to a clip of a conversation with Hugo Berkeley, the director of the film. This bit actually starts with Charlie Persip, who is Dizzy Gillespie's drummer, talking about how he was treated after a performance in the United States.
We were in St. Louis, and we were waiting for the driver to come get us. And one of the police walked up. Of course, he used the N-word. So what are y'all doing in this car? And Wade Leggy, who was the pianist at that time, said, what's it to you? He should have never said that. This man pulled his gun out and pointed it to my forehead and cocked it and said, I'll blow your black brains out. So I just sat there rigid in fear, but I didn't say nothing. And that was that. So we didn't play South that often. Thank God.
As drummer Charlie Persip talking about how he was treated after a performance in St. Louis. Meanwhile, he's going to be one of the jazz ambassadors abroad to sell the American way of life to particularly developing countries in the time of the Cold War. My guest is Hugo Berkeley, and his new documentary is called Jazz Ambassadors, The Untold Story of America's Coolest Weapon in the Cold War. I mean, this was the problem. This was the conflict and the paradox that they faced, right? The idea, first of all, it's work to be part of this program. Secondly, Adam Clayton Powell Jr.'s aspiration that we would somehow have better contact and engagement with particularly African countries, people of color around the world. So you could be part of that. On the other hand, you're also promoting what is essentially a lie. And this is the challenge they faced. Hugo?
That's absolutely, that sums it up very nicely. And I think what I discovered through making the film, and what to me is the really empowering part of this story, is that each of these musicians was able to find their own way of responding to this paradox, of kind of squaring that circle, both being able to promote America, and I think within the context of the Cold War, they were very patriotic. They believed that America presented a better way of life. I think on some level, all of the musicians who I spoke to and who I read about believed that America was on a path to kind of equality and civil rights reform that still had a ways to go. Yet, you know, they obviously had to go out there and tell the truth about their experience. And that is the really strong part of their response to the answer. Dizzy Gillespie said, yes, I'll go on this tour. I'll take my band with me, but I'm not going to go out there and apologize for the racist policies of America. I know what's been done to me, and I'm going to tell it like it is. Famously, when he was asked to go in for a briefing, he said, I've got 300 years of briefing on this issue. So, you know, everybody had their own way of responding to this to this request, and that's what's very empowering about the story, I believe.
Here's what Louis Armstrong had to say.
What are you going to tell the Russians when they ask you about the Little Rock incident?
It all depends what time they send me over there. I don't think they should send me now unless they straighten that mess down south. And for good, I mean, not just to blow over, to cut it out, I think. Because they've been ignoring the Constitution, although they taught it in school. But when they go home, their parents tell them different. Say, you don't have to abide by it because we've been getting away with it 100 years. So nobody tells on each other, so don't bother with it. So if they ask me what's happening, if I go now, I can't tell a lie, that's one thing. You know, what's lying the way I feel about it.
Louis Armstrong talking to reporters about what he would tell the Russians while on tour in the Soviet Union. My guest is the documentary filmmaker Hugo Barclay. He has produced a film called The Jazz Ambassadors, The Untold Story of America's Coolest Weapon in the Cold War. And joining us now is Adrienne Lentz-Smith. She's an advisor to the Jazz Ambassadors, a professor in the history department at Duke University, and also the author of Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War I. Adrienne, welcome back.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be here.
Give us a little more context again about the we touched on it a minute ago about the relationship and the United States' anxieties about winning hearts and minds abroad, given its own trouble at home.
Right. Well, you have to remember, right, the first jazz tour is 56 or 57, and Brown v. Board, the Supreme Court ordering desegregation of schools is 54. The Bandung Conference of African and Asian countries in Indonesia is 55. So the two things that are happening in the context of this, the accelerating and intensifying civil rights struggle and decolonization, and with it the decisions that newly independent states have to make about how they're going to position themselves within the contest between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, are shaping all of this, right? All of the both the way that the foreign and the domestic are intertwining shape how the State Department makes decisions about what they're going to speak to the world.
That was a clip of our conversation with documentary film director Hugo Barclay and historian and film consultant Adrienne Lentz-Smith. And my guest is State of Things producer Amanda Magnus talking about her favorites from 2018. So why did that clip make the list?
So just like I said, it's something that I learned that I had no idea about that particular part of the Cold War. I also, the audio that we got to play in that segment was really interesting, some of the historical archives. And just that film in particular was done really well. And I was really excited to have a chance to watch it and to see it before it opened at the Documentary Film Festival. And in particular, I think that clip shows something that we do really well here that I'm really excited to be a part of, which is kind of not just talking about the film, but including a historian to kind of put that film in a larger context. And I think that's really special about what we do on the State of Things. And that's why I thought that was a great clip.
Well, you've been here for a year. It doesn't seem like you've packed to leave, so I'm guessing you're going to stay. What have you learned? What have you thought about this first year?
Working on this show has been such a great way for me to learn about my new home, and not just Durham and the Triangle, but the state of North Carolina. I felt really lucky to have these opportunities to learn about all the different things going on here. I love Durham. I love living in Durham. It's been really great. And I'm just excited for a new year of programming.
Well, we're very happy to have you. Thank you so much. And thanks for bringing all of your great talent to this program. Happy New Year.
Thanks, Frank. You too.
Amanda Magnus, producer on The State of Things. You can find links to all the stuff we do, including the segments that she mentioned, at our website, stateofthings.org. In addition to Amanda, The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, and Dana Terry. Robin Copley's our technical director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.